purely vertical that's perpendicular to the table. Now you want to put the probe in some other direction by drilling a hole in the slotted line. Wow, there's a lot of ways you could do that. I'm a little bit confused by this one now. So are you drilling a hole through both sides of the slotted line slightly above the center conductor, and you're sticking the probe in from the side as opposed from the top, and you're only sticking the probe in halfway so it doesn't stick out the other slab, if you know what I mean? Give me a few more words as to what you intend to do, John. Go ahead.
Okay, degrees I was talking about when the cardinal points of a compass, the way it's mounted now, that's north, so that's 0 or 360. If I moved it to the east radially, now it would be a 90-degree position. The probe would be going in toward the center conductor at a 90-degree position. Got that?
No, I don't. Boy, I must be thick tonight. 0 and 360 became 90. Cardinal position. Cardinal position of what? Are you translating or rotating the whole slotted line but keeping the feet of the slotted line on the table? Or are you tippling the slotted line over so it's laying sideways on the table? So are you rotating the slotted line but keeping its feet on the table? Or are you rotating the slot? That's rotating it about a vertical axis. Or are you rotating about its center conductor axis, and therefore the slotted line is laying flat on the table? Who's being rotated 90 degrees with reference to what? Over to you, John.
Dick, I apologize for my poor description. Okay, let's assume that the slotted line is normal. You've got that opening on the top, the carriage slides back and forth, the transport for the probe. Now, supposing we had another opening, exactly the same as the top, the slot, that we could mount the transport to on one of the sides. The highs and low points should be exactly the same, correct?
And now I'm getting the picture. And by the way, to put a carriage on the side where you've got all of these casting bumps in order to give the slabs stiffness, it would be very difficult to do. But yes, let me think now. If you had another slot on the side, and you stuck the probe in the exact same depth, same closeness to center conductor, without a doubt, you would measure the exact same locations of peak and valley, the exact same magnitudes of peak and valley. I'm now getting the picture. So there's a slot along the side of the slotted line, and you've got a carriage mounted on the side. Yes, I agree with that. Proceed, John.
Okay, now I hope I can convert this to an intelligent question. Now, those pearls that are on that line, which represent the E and the H field, I wanted to know if we could put a dot on one of those pearls. As that waveform is traveling down my slotted line, are those pearls rotating, which would inscribe a helix if you follow the dot? Do you think that is happening to that E field and H field? I know they have to stay at 90 degrees, but do you think they are rotating? Can you understand that?
Yes, I do. Darn good question. And the answer is no. If the wave going down your slotted line was a circular polarized wave and a round piece of waveguide without a center conductor, now without a doubt there would be rotation. In the case of a TEM structure, in other words, an ordinary center conductor that's round and outer conductor that's round in coaxial cable, if I have those pearls which represent individual wave structures going down the center conductor, and I stop time and I stop the action, in ordinary round coaxial cable, if I plotted the E field, I would find the E field at the, assume now that the pearl is located at the point of maximum E field, maximum positive E field, and the next probe is the maximum negative E field. So I look at the maximum positive E field, And that's the one that's got the dot on the pearl. And I'm looking at the E field in ordinary round coax cable in cross section. I would see a whole bunch of radial lines of E field traveling from semiconductor out toward the perimeter. There would be A line at 12 o'clock, A line at 1 o'clock, A line at 2 o'clock in cross section. I've done a slice through the coax cable. And so there'd be an equal spacing of lines all the way around the clock. That represents the strength of the E field. The E field would not favor 12 o'clock, would not favor 3 o'clock, would not favor 9 o'clock or 6 o'clock. Let me drop. The H field would be curved lines around the semiconductor, sort of like a spring. But a spring has got an advancement on each turn. The spring of magnetic field does not have an advancement. It's a bunch of rings of magnetic field, individual rings. It's not a spiral. It's not a helix. That's what the H field looks like in a round coax cable. Now, in the case of the slotted line, well, let me go back to the round coaxial cable in cross-section. There's nothing magic about round. I could very slowly convert the semiconductor from round to square. I could very slowly convert the outer conductor from round to square. And the lines would disturb a little bit. In other words, the lines going up at 12 o'clock versus 1:30 would change a little bit in strength, because in one case they're going the shortest distance, in the other case they're going the diagonal distance across a square cross-section. There'd be a little bit of perturbation of that kind. But once you resolve that, no real problem. In the case of two vertical slabs for a Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line, you're now going the next step. You got a round semiconductor, but the outer conductor is two vertical slabs. And the two vertical slabs is one on the right-hand side and the one on the left-hand side when I'm looking at in cross-section. The slabs are closer at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and there is no slab at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. So the E field lines coming out at 12 o'clock curve over toward the slab somewhere above 3 o'clock, if you know what I mean. So there's going to be a concentration of E field lines stronger at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, because that's where the closest spacing is of these vertical slabs. So there's a disturbance in the arrangement of those E field lines, but still the general trend of the E field lines is going from semiconductor out toward outer conductor. And those H-field lines, again, are rings around the semiconductor. So there is no twist as that goes down the guide. If I plotted E-field versus the Z-axis, and I stopped time, I'd be plotting a sine wave of magnitude and polarity versus position. And the same thing for H-field. And by the way, let me think about this. Yes, in the position where the E field is maximum, that happens to be the exact same position where the H field is maximum. So yes, they really do act like pearls with empty spaces in between. And that's not easy to explain. How do those empty spaces propagate? But they do. So maybe this helps a little bit. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
DC2WGB. Okay, that forces me to pose one other ridiculous question. The spacing between that H field, those little disks, does that change with frequency?
Absolutely. Your slotted line is an air line. There is no real dielectric in there other than air. Therefore, the speed of the signal going down that line is identical to the speed of a signal in free space going through air. Uh, 2.997925 exponential 8 meters per second. If I go to a higher frequency, the wavelength is shorter, but what I'm getting at is the wavelength in free space and the wavelength inside of your slotted line is the identical wavelength. If I'm operating at 432 megacycles, where the wavelength of free space is 27 inches, inside of your slotted line, the wavelength is 27 inches. Half of 27 inches is what? 14? 13 and a half inches. As I go 13 and a half inches along your slotted line, I will go from a positive peak to a negative peak in E field polarity and magnitude. And so as I change frequency, the spacing between those positive and negative peaks will exactly follow wavelength dimensions, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. Thank you for that observation. That's good to know, because I was very confused if there was a radial translation, which would be a spiral going down there as those beads supposedly are moving down that line. But, yeah, you covered it good. Thank you very much for that info, and back to you, sir.
Yeah, those beads do not rotate per se. On each half wave, the positive E field, the lines are going from center conductor out toward the perimeter in cross section. But let's keep it simple and make believe that your slotted line happened to have a round outer conductor, which you could, with great difficulty, you could construct a round outer conductor and a round center conductor with a narrow slot there. It doesn't have to be a slab. The nice thing about the slab is that it's a great big high vertical pair of vertical walls where the slot in between is waveguide beyond cutoff. The slot does not radiate. If I built it more compactly as a real piece of Andrew Heliax, and I use my Dremel tool and file a slot alongside of the in the Z-axis, I file a slot in the outer conductor of the Andrew Heliax, I could do a good job of making a slotted line. But that slot that I just described in the Andrew Heliax would radiate a little bit. It would be 25 dB down, but it would radiate. Because if you study Radiax, which is a product made by Heliax, it's a bunch of holes drilled in the outer conductor, and it slowly radiates the signal. It's a weak signal, but it does radiate. The advantage of the Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line with those two vertical slabs is that the distance between the center conductor and the outside air is now such a long distance. All of that distance is waveguide beyond cutoff. The amount of signal that radiates out of that slot is probably 75 dB down. It's a very weak signal. If you retracted that probe so that it's parallel to the upper surface that the carriage slides on, the amount of signal you could detect there with the most sensitive receiver you got, you might not be able to detect the signal. It could very well be 80 or 100 dB weaker than the signal that's on the center conductor because there's such a long slot of waveguide beyond cutoff. Whereas with the real slot you make with a Dremel tool in your Andrew Heliax, the spacing between center conductor and the outside world is so much closer, so much smaller, it would do some radiating. Let me drop. But still, in theory, you could make Andrew Heliax with very little support plastic so that the majority of it is airline, and therefore the wavelength inside would be identical to the wavelength in free space. A linear polarized wave in free space has no circularity to it, has no rotation going on. The energy is, assuming the signal came from a long distance away and it's coming into your backyard in Staten Island, it would look like sheets of energy, completely flat sheets propagating directly toward you. The first sheet that hit you would be positive in voltage polarity. The next sheet would be negative in voltage polarity. And in between, the energy would go to zero. And in that sheet that you saw positive voltage polarity, which means if it's a vertically polarized wave, the E field would be pointing up on the first sheet, and the second sheet, the E field would be pointing down. The H field on the first sheet would be pointing, let me think now, to your left as you looked at it. The H field line of the second sheet would be pointing toward your right as you looked at it. H field would be exactly at right angles to the E field. You could draw a whole bunch of vertical parallel lines representing the E field in the sheet. you could draw a whole bunch of horizontal parallel lines representing the H field in the sheet, and each sheet, both of those would reverse in polarity, but they would not rotate. The signal in between the two simply decreases in magnitude, going to zero in between, and does not rotate for a linear polarized wave. I'll warn you, life gets complicated with circular polarization. But with linear polarization, everything is nice and parallel, up and down for the E field, for a vertically polarized signal.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Question.
And the H field is horizontal for a, again, a vertically polarized signal. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I would like to have some clarification about it. An electromagnetic wave traveling in the conductor cable produces an electric and magnetic field between inner conductor and outer conductor. Okay. The electric field, E field, is radial and varies in time. Fine. Now, the alternating current flows along the inner conductor and the outer conductor. An oscillating magnetic field, H field, circles in the inner conductor. Now, you said it's pointing. It's circling.
Oh, let's go step by step now. It is a TEM, transverse electromagnetic wave, in the round coaxial cable and in free space. At every point in both of those transmission mediums, everywhere the E and this H is at right angles. In the case of the E field wave, in case of a vertically polarized wave in free space, coming into John's backyard, E field lines are up and down, H field lines are at right, are left and right, and E crossed H is the direction of pointing. That's the Z axis, the direction of propagation. So if the E was at 12 o'clock, if I'm looking at the wave that approaches me, and I'm looking at the way I would normally look at a clock on the wall, and if the E field is pointing at 12 o'clock, from my point of view, the H field would be pointing at 9 o'clock. When I cross E into H, it would be the advancement of a right angle of an ordinary right-handed screw thread, and it would be screwing itself right toward John's nose, if you know what I mean, E crossed H.
You're talking about the free space, you're talking about the correction table.
I'm talking about free space first. Now I'm going to compare it to a coax cable. The E field in a coax cable is always radial. The H field is a bunch of rings. At every place along that cable, E and H are at right angles to each other.
Let me stop you for a moment. Radial means that you have a series of vectors from the center conductor at 90 degrees to the center conductor facing the shield.
That's correct. If I cut across the coax cable in cross section, and I look down the cable, I'm looking at a round center conductor in the middle, and the remains of the outer conductor beyond that. Each of the E field lines are radial. Some of those E field lines go from center conductor up toward 12 o'clock. Some of them go to 1 o'clock. Some of them go to 2 o'clock. All the way around, radial. That's the E field lines. The H field lines are a bunch of rings around the center conductor. The rings change in magnitude as I look deeper into the Z axis of the cable. If I slice the cable and stop time right at the point where the voltage is the maximum, at that point the rings of H are also maximum.
In other words, if 12 o'clock is the maximum, then 9 o'clock is the maximum for the ring of magnetic field?
Absolutely not. Stand by. In coaxial cable, the E field lines are radial. They are not parallel. In free space, the E field lines are all parallel. The H field lines are all parallel at right angles in free space. In a coaxial cable, the E field lines are radial. Equal magnitude. If I slice the cable right at the point where the E field is maximum, and I stopped time and I study it, the E field lines are going from center conductor toward the outer conductor in a radial manner. That's the E field lines.
So all of the lines, all of the vectors at 90 degrees from the center conductors are equal in magnitude.
Spokes on a wheel.
That's a good point. They are spokes on a wheel, all equal in magnitude. 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 7:30, they're all the same magnitude at that position, at that instant of time. The H-field lines in the coax cable are a bunch of rings around the center conductor. And the rings are strongest in magnitude just outside the center conductor, and they get weaker and weaker as I go out to the outer conductor. And those rings of H-field are always at right angles to the E-field. The rings of H-field are strongest at the Z-axis where the E-field is maximum. If I go a little bit further down the cable, inside the cable, to where the E-field has gone through zero, and I keep going further, I'll see the opposite polarity, the other half wavelength, if you know what I mean. But if I stop at the point midway between the positive peak and the negative peak, and the in the case of 432 megacycles where the wavelength is 27 inches, I go 13 and a half inches, that's half wave, quarter wave is six and a fraction inches. I go six and a fraction inches down the cable. The E field has gone to zero. The H field has gone to zero. So I have now traversed the first bead, if you know what I mean, of this bead of these pearls on the string. And the next pearl is the opposite polarity, where the E field is now all going from outside, from the outer conductor toward the center conductor. And there's an equal number of lines at 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 1:30, and so on, all the way around. So everything is identical, a half wavelength down the cable, except all polarities have reversed. The E field that used to go out now goes in.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
The rings of H, which used to go from my point of view counterclockwise, half wavelength down, are clockwise. And so their strength of H and the strength of E changes with reference to Z-axis of the cable in a sinusoidal manner. E and H both go to a peak at the same spot, both go to a valley at the same spot, and as I plot their magnitude versus Z-axis position along the cable, they're changing in a sinusoidal manner. That's when I stop time. I take that beautiful waveform I just described to you, describe all of that stuff, and now let it slide along the cable at the speed of light when I allow time to start flowing forward again. All of that complicated waveform stays exactly the way it is, except that now everything moves, it translates at the speed of light. Wonder if you're slowly getting that picture, John. KC2WGB. Darn good question. A lot of people don't know this one. K2RIW.
I have a further question in this matter.
Okay. You know, first, Dick, I'll point out. Let me get the beep. You're 100% right with the slotted line, because what I've done, I've taken my sniffer near that slotted line. No signal. I actually have to go into the body of that slotted line to pick up a signal. And I'm assuming that's exactly what you were explaining before.
Absolutely. If you took a piece of Andrew Heliax and with your Dremel tool, with the cutting wheel, the thin little ceramic cutting wheel, you made a very thin slot along the outer conductor of the Andrew Heliax, parallel to the center conductor, and you made a slot, let me pick a number, 2 inches long. And now you put your sniffer in that slot. You're going to measure a signal, a fairly big signal. The reason for that is that the E-field lines going from center conductor toward the outer conductor are quite strong in the vicinity of where you're putting your sniffer. And you're going to pick up those E-field lines. You're very close to the center conductor. In the case of your 805 slotted line, those parallel plates are, let me pick a number, 8 or 10 inches high, plus or minus 4 or 5 inches, and their waveguide beyond cutoff. And now, when you put your sniffer right at the outer edge of that slotted line, you are so darn many inches away from that semiconductor, and although that slot to your eye looks like a very big, wide slot, that slot is what? A healthy half-inch wide. It looks like the signal should come roaring out of there like no tomorrow. Good common sense. But the spacing between those two plates in wavelengths is so darn small. What is it, about a 1-inch wavelength? 1/27th of a wavelength at 432 megacycles. That whole great big vertical channel is all waveguide beyond cutoff. The signal is falling off 27 dB per ground plane spacing. Your ground plane spacing is about an inch. You're going up 4 or 5 inches.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a universal rule of thumb for triplate strip line. The signal falls off out of the outer open edges, 27 dB per ground plane spacing. In my mental image of your slotted line, the spacing between those two vertical walls is about half an inch, and you're going up a healthy 3 or 4 inches from the semiconductor until you get to the upper outer air. So let's assume it's 4 inches, half inch ground plane spacing, 4 inches up, that's 8 ground plane spacings. 27 dB per ground plane spacing, 8 times 27 dB. Do you see where we're going here, John? My guess is that signal was around 100 dB down with your sniffer right at the upper edge. Unless you've got an extremely sensitive receiver, you ain't going to see anything there. And if you've got a receiver that sensitive, just the leakage from your coax cable braid and the leakage from your type N connectors will also be contaminating the test. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, excellent. Yes, I understand that fully. I'd like to give you my thoughts on the bead. I'd like to give you a physical description to see if I'm right.
Fire away. When it comes to what does a real radio wave look like in free space, in a coax cable, or in a slotted line, the number of books you can go to that will give you a nice, clear description of that. Wow. I don't know if there is one.
And boy, I have a question.
And boy, did I need that description when this was being described to me in the college I went to. And all they did is give me a blackboard full of equations and say, it's there. To which I said to myself, you've got to be kidding. Over to you, John, and then we'll go over to Wesley in that order. Go ahead, John.
WA2SAY.
Station recognized. Let me get the beep tick. Okay, Dick, if I were to take a string and we'll cut some circles like washers, different diameters, we'll start from, say, 1/4 inch, and we'll go up 1/4 inch, and then until we get to our maximum, and then we'll reduce it the same way in 1/4 inch increments. We'll space them, say, 1/2 inch apart. That should give me a description of the H field. And if we laid wires parallel with the center conductor, which is supporting these washers, over the top of that, that should represent the E field in the sine wave. Is that basically what it looks like?
I think the answer is no, unfortunately. You described it before as a string of pearls. Assume I've got a string of round pearls on a string, and the pearls are very close to each other, not quite touching. And the string that the pearls are on represents the semiconductor of the coax cable. If I've got X-ray eyes and I'm looking inside those pearls is one way of looking at it, or I could take a whole lot of slices through those pearls at right angles to the string. I took a whole lot of slices of those pearls, and the diameter of each slice represents the magnitude of the E field in that area of the pearl. Assuming now that each one of my pearls are a half wavelength apart, the very first pearl, the one that's closest to your nose right now, that's the positive polarity pearl. The next pearl downrange, half wave away, is the negative polarity pearl. And the third pearl downrange, is the next positive polarity pearl. And I could now take a whole bunch of slices through each one of those pearls at right angles to the string. The diameter of each one of those slices represents the magnitude of the E field in that area along that string. Now, the outer surface of the pearls, I could, yes, draw a piece of wire along the outer surface and run it up along the Z axis of the string of pearls. Let me drop. And as my wire runs across the top of pearl number one, goes through zero, and then my wire goes to the bottom of pearl number two, and I look at that sideways, cross at right angles, so to speak, I'm now looking at a sine wave. That sine wave that we just described, the outer surface of the pearl, represents the magnitude along that direction, along that position, and the polarity. Maybe that helps a little bit.
And that would be the E field.
That's the E field. It turns out that the H field is changing in strength and position in the exact same way. But the H field is a bunch of rings around the center conductor. And now, describing the strength of the rings along the Z axis of the center conductor, that's tracing out that sine wave. The rings get a little bit more complicated when I talk about the rings that are closest to the center conductor versus the rings that are closest to the outer conductor in the vicinity of the maximum position of the diameter of the pearl. Pearl number one, I decided to draw some rings right where the pearl is maximum in diameter. That's where the E field is maximum. That's where the H field is maximum. And the rings are a whole bunch of concentric rings. The rings are stronger near the center conductor, weaker near the outer conductor. I'm now plotting the thickness of the ring representing the strength of the H field in that area. Is that starting to make a little bit more of a picture? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. Okay, not to belabor it, but then those washers or those pearl slices would be represented by a little thicker near the conductor, the center conductor, and become thinner as they came up to the surface to represent their energy. Would that be a better concept?
Give that man a cigar. You got it. Now, up till now, I've been showing you E-field lines that I said that go from center conductor out to the outer conductor at 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and so on. Yes, you're now going into the next level. The E-field lines are strongest near the center conductor. The H-field lines are strongest near the center conductor. At each little position, each little square millimeter where you could analyze one of those slices of the pearl, the magnitude of the E-field and the magnitude of H-field have got an exact relationship to each other. If one is twice as strong as the other near the center conductor, they're twice as strong as the other near the outer conductor, but they're both weaker. So yes, E field is strongest near the center conductor, weakest near the outer conductor. If coaxial cable is ever going to arc over, the arc over begins at the center conductor. I know that Doug out on the East Coast wants to, out on the East End wants to ask a question. W-H-U-S-A-Y.
I have a question as well.
I know. W-H-U-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Good evening, Dick, in the net, this is W-H-U-S-A-Y. I had a question. You had specified 27 dB per spacing in the parallel plate type structure. In other words, the strip line type structure. In a round structure, I was always told that the attenuation is 30 dB per diameter. Is this a
In the case of triplate strip line, Doug, where I've got an upper slab, a lower slab, and a strip down the middle, that is the center conductor, and in most cases I adjust those widths and spacing so I get something like 50 ohms most of the time. And now, if in my triplate strip line transmission line structure, I didn't bother putting any vertical sides way out around the perimeter. I have this completely open structure held together with nylon rods, if you know what I mean. And now I slip my machinist ruler, I slip it into the side, and I measure how many inches is there between the edge of the center conductor and the outer edge of the ground planes. And I measure, let me pick a number, 1 inch. And my particular ground planes, the upper ground plane and the lower ground plane, are quarter inch apart. So I've got a quarter inch ground plane spacing, and I've got 1 inch of distance between center conductor and outer edge with no shielding of any kind. That signal falls off 27 dB per ground plane spacing. Good round rule of thumb given to you and me by a guy named Hank Keene, W2CTK, now a silent key. And he's lived with that for years and calculated all kinds of his rotary joints with that, and it came out on the money most of the time. Let me drop. So that came directly from Hank Keene way back in the 50s when he and Mr. Cohen were inventing all of these techniques for strip line. So one of the co-inventors of strip line was one of my early mentors. Real fun to talk to him. Slightly cantankerous guy, but real fun to talk to. Now, in the case of round cable, describing the ground plane spacing and the distance between center conductor and ground plane, it don't have the same analogy. So where you told me 30 dB per something, I'm having trouble picturing what the something is there, Doug. W2SAY, K2RIW.
This is W2SAY. No, I'm not talking about a tube, a piece of pipe, if you will, where the attenuation along the length of the pipe is 30 dB per diameter. Does that ring a bell to you, Dick?
Okay, maybe you're now talking about the piston attenuator that's in the Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, for instance. That's a round piece of pipe, without a doubt, is waveguide beyond cutoff, and you're saying that each time you travel down the pipe, a distance that is equal to the diameter of the pipe, the signal falls off 30 dB. Boy, I think that's very close to the real number, if that's what you're saying. So I think you're talking about a waveguide beyond cutoff piston-type attenuator on, say, for instance, what's in on the output circuit of a Hewlett-Packard 608. Over to you, Doug, K2RIW.
K2RIW, this is W2SAY. Yes, you're correct, Dick. That's what I'm talking about. And I'm wondering why there is a difference between that and your strip line number.
I can think of a number of reasons for that, Doug. In the case of the strip line, triplate strip line, you have a pure TEM structure. In other words, it's very easy to predict exactly where the E-field lines are going from center conductor to each of the ground plane slabs and the way those lines arrange themselves. In the case of a piece of round waveguide, the signal that does propagate down there does not propagate straight down the guide like it does with a TEM structure. It is a zigzag. All signals going down a waveguide do not go straight down the guide just like your eyesight does. You open up a piece of waveguide and you look down it and you assume that since your eyesight goes straight down the guide, you assume the radio wave does that. Absolutely not. When you walk into a barber shop and you see the mirror on the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall, and you look at that mirror at a 45-degree angle, and you see the barber down there four times in a row if he's at the back of the barber shop. Let me drop. You see that barber four times in a row by looking at him in a zigzag manner across those parallel mirrors. That's exactly what the waveguide does in round and in rectangular waveguide. in the case of rectangular waveguide, it zigzags back and forth between the two narrow vertical walls, which is crazy, opposite from common sense. But the signal zigzags down there at an extremely exact angle, depending on wavelength and spacing of those two horizontal, spacing of those two vertical walls. I'm now laying the piece of waveguide down on the table in the most stable manner. So the signal always goes down there by zigzag. In the case of a round piece of waveguide, it is zigzagging the exact same way, just that it's very difficult for you and I to envision how it zigzags and bounces off of a curved wall instead of a flat wall. It's a lot more difficult for you and I to picture the way that signal is bouncing off the curved wall and reforming itself on each bounce, but it does do that. But because of that that round, it's a slightly different configuration. I'm going to believe that the 30 dB per diameter distance of waveguide fall off, I'm going to believe that's very close. Why is it 27 instead of 30? There's a lot of difference in geometry here. I'm going to accept that. Where did you hear the 30 dB number, Doug? I've never heard the 30 dB. I should have. I've never heard the 30 dB number before, but I think there's a good chance it's very close to being on the money. To the A2SAY, K2RIW.
W and the net W-A-2-S-A-Y. Yeah, something like, it must be close to 40 years ago, we designed a waveguide beyond cutoff attenuator for roughly a gigahertz and a piece of test equipment, and I didn't come up with the 30 dB number. I don't really know where it came from. I just remember it.
I'm beginning to think I've seen a derivation of it, and I think the exact number is 29.97 or some crazy number like that. Very close to 30. If we go to one of the very old microwave handbooks, I can't think of the name of the book now. I own a book that probably handles this. It was a 1938 book, which I've got a copy of, and this book has got all kinds of pictures of what the signal looks like going down round waveguide in the first mode, the second mode, the 13th mode, and so on. And that was back in the days when there was no computer-generated graphics. Somebody had to do all these calculations by hand and draw these pictures. And how the hell they did that in 1938, I don't know, but somebody did. And so I think there was an exact derivation, and I'll bet you it's just a skosh under 30 dB. You know, very few things in Mother Nature come out exactly even for us. And we're not being favored, as you know, Doug. We're the detritus in this universe. I know that you've got some questions on this, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I have a series of quick questions. First, is there any chance if you have a slotted slot in a slotted line at 12 o'clock that E field could extend over the edge of the slotted line?
That's exactly the question that John asked and answered before. He made that measurement. I predicted the signal would be 100 dB down or so. He tried to look for the signal squirting out of the top of the slotted line. By good common sense, you look at that slotted line. It's got a huge amount of open space. Your eye can look down there with this great big wide slot, and you see that center conductor down there, 3 inches or 4 inches down. It looks like it's open as all hell. Your mind can easily envision that signal running out of there like water pouring out of a hole in the bucket, if you know what I mean.
The H field does not. There is a very tight relation between E field and H field. So if the H field cannot, E field cannot.
You got it. Remember when we were talking about slicing those pearls, and we were saying that the E field and the H field changes in a characteristic way, the slices getting bigger and larger in diameter. Also, the E field is stronger near the center conductor and weaker near the outer conductor. So is the H field, and they follow each other in the exact same ratio. The E field in that slotted line is extremely weak, falling off 27 dB per ground plane spacing as you go away from the semiconductor toward the upper opening of that slot, the H field follows suit. If the E field is down 100 dB, the H field is down 100 dB. They follow each other. Over to you, Wes.
Other question too, Dick.
So I have a problem with some of the descriptions that you gave. Let me jump. I'm sorry, John. you said about the speed of light in coaxial cable. Well, velocity of propagation when the electromagnetic wave travels in the medium other than air or vacuum, then the velocity for the wave is reduced by the factor of square root of the dielectric constant of the media. So the velocity then belongs to the certain equation ruling the dielectric constant of the medium, and to XJM.
You're absolutely right. And that makes a very simple proportional change. If I'm using a medium where I've got something like Teflon, I'm going to make a guess. If Teflon had a dielectric constant of 4, and the square root of 4 is 2, my velocity of propagation in Teflon is half the speed of light. In the case of John's slotted line, inside that slotted line of his is nothing but air. That wave inside his slotted line is moving at the speed of light. When he moves that carriage X number of millimeter on that outer scale, on that carriage, on that slotted line, he is moving that number of millimeters of free space wavelength of that wave going down the line. He could use that slotted line and measure the distance between two consecutive valleys with extremely high accuracy. That'll tell him exactly what wavelength it is, because he's got air as a dielectric and he knows the velocity of propagation. It's very close to the speed of light. Therefore, he could, with three or four decimal places of accuracy, figure out the frequency of the signal going down his slotted line, assuming there's one signal. You got to be careful. If that slotted line has a primary signal and the second harmonic and the third harmonic, and they're mixed together in a complicated way, and you look for the consecutive peaks and valleys, it'll drive you crazy. Assuming there's one single frequency going down that line, and you measure the distance between two consecutive notches, and you know that that's exactly half a wave, and you go through the mathematics, you know the exact wavelength, you know the exact frequency going down that line, assuming there's only one. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, I was going to ask you, also, the size of the aperture compared to the radiation pattern of the E-field cuts down a lot of the radiation besides, does it not?
The main thing that's making your slotted line such an open-looking structure to your eye, but such an extremely well-shielded structure as far as that radio wave is going down there, is two things. Number one, the open area above the slotted line, where the carriage is X number of ground plane spacings of center conductor to outer opening ratio. So, if you've got half an inch of spacing between your two plates, and it's 3 inches between the center conductor and the outer opening on top, that is six spacings, 6 times 27 dB, is a lot of dB. You've got a lot of shielding. There's a catch. You put a signal down that waveguide of, let me pick a number, 24 gigahertz, where now the spacing between the two plates, half wavelength, happens to be a half wavelength at 24 gigahertz. Now you've got a antenna. That thing will radiate like crazy at 24 gigahertz. Even though you got a lot of ground plane spacing, you're going to be launching a beautiful signal, because now you've got a guided wave coming out of a slot, which is not a waveguide beyond cutoff anymore. You see what I'm saying, John? Don't use it at 24 gigs when you go there. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, great answer. Pick up with. Good line. I'm gonna try some of those experiments and see where it will radiate at, maybe next week. Back to you.
All you got to do is know the ground plane spacing, calculate that, what frequency is that, a half wavelength, and that's where it's going to begin radiating like crazy. Over to you, John. Wes.
Yeah, I'm going to make some summaries. Would you say to make sure that I understand the problem? Because of the dielectric constant, we're dealing with some energy loss. So let's say, so that would be kind of an attenuation, right? Okay, the resistance of inner and outer conductors is small, but can be significant over the longer length and will produce some heat. Dielectric may cause loss. Its resistance is high, but not infinite, and some energy is lost. Electromagnetic energy radiates at higher frequencies. Significant energy losses are caused by the radiation of the electromagnetic energy. The cable acts like an antenna. The energy is reflected due to the impedance mismatches or impedance discontinuities. The combination of these types of losses is reflected as the insertion loss of the transmission line system. I wonder if I understand it properly. And another question that I have is, what if I put a square signal into the coaxial cable?
When I start putting dielectric material into a transmission line, it could be tri-plate strip line, it could be microstrip, it could be coax cable, it could be a slotted line, like the 805. When I start putting dielectric material in there, 1 over the square root of the dielectric material is the new velocity of propagation. It is the ratio of the new wavelength. So the wavelength gets smaller, the velocity gets slower, because I put dielectric material. Just because I put dielectric material doesn't mean I've created extra loss. If I'm smart enough to use material that has a very low loss tangent, like Teflon, like certain kinds of polystyrene, like Rexolite. But let's just talk about Teflon. Teflon has a loss tangent that is so extremely low that the major thing that you'll see when you add the Teflon is you change the wavelength and you change the velocity of propagation. You may see very little difference in loss. When it comes to loss of a coax cable, let me drop. Even though you've got dielectric materials there, at the lower frequencies, 99% of the loss is loss in the copper due to skin effect. You're not using all the copper. You're only using the outer 10,000th of an inch of the skin of the copper. So you're using very little of it, and the rest is not doing you any benefit. You might as well make it hollow when it comes to the center conductor. And when it comes to the outer conductor of coax cable, for radio-wise, you could make it very thin. Strength-wise, you don't want to do that, but for radio-wise, you could make it very thin. You get the same loss. So at lower frequencies, all of the loss per se is copper loss, and the copper loss follows 1 over square root of frequency. Make the frequency go 4 times higher. The loss due to copper loss will be twice as high. It's 1 over square root of frequency is the copper loss. If you take a look at the loss curves in any of the good books of all the cables you can buy, let me drop. When it's plotted on graph paper that is logarithmic in frequency to the right, logarithmic in decibels vertical, when you plot it on that kind of log paper, your coaxial cable throughout most of the frequency region is roughly a 45 degree line of loss versus frequency. But if you look carefully at all of those cables, you'll see that at the end of the higher frequency where you stop, where they want you to stop using the cable, it has a sudden upward hook. That's where the dielectric loss is starting to dominate, is starting to come into effect. At most of the lower frequencies, the majority of the loss is copper loss if it's a quality piece of cable. Only when the dielectric loss starts happening at the higher frequencies, now you're getting copper loss and dielectric loss added together. And now you get this upper hook of a loss versus frequency. And it's usually very close to the point where the cable starts acting as a piece of waveguide, multimoding, and you're not supposed to go there. A piece of 7/8 inch Andrew Heliax, for instance, I think you're not supposed to use it above something like 4 or 5 gigahertz, because it's starting to become a round piece of waveguide, and it doesn't even care about your semiconductor anymore. A smart ham radio operator doesn't have to worry about this. Let me drop. You go to that section called the North Texas Roadrunners. There was a K5RMG, Roadrunner Microwave Group, K5RMG.com or something like that, or .org. And you'll see a bunch of articles by K2RIW on the technical page. And one of them was talking about the fact that you can easily estimate the coax cable loss from one frequency to another. In other words, if you know that copper loss falls off at square root of frequency, and somebody told you what the loss of your favorite cable is at 2 meters, and you want to use it at 432, there's a very simple mental mathematics you can do to estimate what's the loss going to be at 432, because they told you the loss at 2 meters. It's because it's the square root of a frequency function. Up until you get the dielectric characteristic loss happening at the higher frequencies. Now, if you go to a frequency where the coaxial cable is capable of supporting both a round waveguide mode and a coaxial mode simultaneously, all the good industrial books and military books will tell you don't do that, because the coaxial mode and the waveguide mode propagate at a different frequency. The waveguide mode is getting down there by zigzag. It gets down there slower. Let me drop. The coaxial mode goes down there only limited by the dielectric, 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant of the dielectric material. Because they have 2 different velocities of propagation, the waveguide mode and the coax mode, at certain positions along the cable, those 2 modes are in phase, and those modes in other places are out of phase. So when you sweep the cable at those upper frequencies, you'll see a very peculiar ripple in insertion loss versus frequency. To a smart ham radio operator who's using narrowband selection, narrowband ham bands, I mean the 10 gig ham band, everybody is 10.368 plus or minus 100 KC. Very narrow percentage of the band do we really use. Therefore, you can carefully adjust your round piece of coaxial cable to simultaneously support the waveguide mode and the coaxial mode and make the 2 come out in phase with each other. And you get a slightly lower loss. Use it to your benefit. It's a narrowband technique, but most of what we do is narrowband, and that can be done. So don't let these curves in the books force you into submission saying that you can't possibly go there. You'll be amazed how many guys are taking a type-N connector, which is never supposed to be used above 18 gigs, and some of the buddies that I've got at San Bernardino Microwave Society in California are putting a 47-gig signal through there. It doesn't behave quite the way they would like it to, but if you're smart enough to figure out what's going on, you can do it, and they're doing it. They are making power measurements at 47 gigs with a barometer that's got a type-N connector on the end of it. It needs a great big correction factor, but they can do it, and it's good enough for what they're trying to do. I don't know who wants it next, K2RIW.
Thanks, Ian.
Go ahead, Wes.
Okay, what if I have a slotted line, and actually I want to have a structure that is circular, like a coaxial cable with a slot on top, and then I put a square wave signal into it. That would be one scenario. And second scenario, I'm trying to create a extent of the E field over the slot. And then the second one is you implement the mismatch to this question.
Yeah, there's really 3 questions there. I'm going to cover all 3 of them. In the case of John's 805 slotted line, because those slabs are so big and they go up so high and all of that open space is waveguide beyond cutoff at the normal frequencies he's using it at, that very open-looking structure is extremely well shielded. If he used his Dremel tool and cut a slot in his Andrew Heliax, he'd have a small amount of radiation. Maybe it would only be 25 dB down. And to an average guy with a transmitter, that's not a great deal loss. To a guy that's doing electromagnetic compatibility and interference.